It's a great privilege to be able to introduce Jonathan Sumption and Ali Ansari. If you read the newspapers every day, however depressing that might be, understanding that the frontier between the legal world and the political world is frayed, under pressure, and different people have very different opinions. And I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating to hear what comes out of this discussion about where we go with democracy and the impact of the legal system on public demands for change. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And it's wonderful to see such a full house. I hope we can all breathe comfortably, take in the oxygen. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Lord Sumption, who's here to talk about challenges of democracy and the role of law in politics. The issue of the Constitution has become something which is very much at the forefront of our public discourse these days. For myself, living north of the border, it's particularly in sharp form about how the Constitution works, whether it does work, what we might do to improve it, and how it compares with other constitutions, written, unwritten, uncodified, however which way you want to describe it. So I'm very pleased that we have a great authority here to come and guide us through a number of the issues. This is a collection of essays, covers a wide range of issues, and there's a huge amount to talk about, but I'm going to focus on a few key areas. And one of the areas that I think I wanted to start with was on your distinction between a political and a legal constitution, and how, in a sense, the British and the American constitutions differ in that matter. Pros and cons, if you will, Lord Sumption.
Well, the classic legal constitution is that of the United States. The great French sociologist Alexis de Tocqueville, writing in the 1830s, said that sooner or later, every political issue in the United States becomes a legal issue. Mm. And he could have written that yesterday, and it would be just as true. Obviously, if you have a code of fundamental law policed by a system of courts, you are in a completely different situation to the one we have here, where in Britain we have a constitution, but it isn't a written constitution, and it isn't there is no code of fundamental law against which you can judge just about any issue. That's the major difference. Many things that in America would be governed by legal principles are in this country governed by conventions, which are essentially rules of practice which are not legally enforceable, but which there is a high political cost associated with breaking them. Obviously, one of the problems about that is that the high political cost depends on everybody accepting what the principles are and that one needs to comply with them. If you have somebody who's determined to break the mold, then our constitution is very vulnerable.
I can't imagine who you might be talking about there. The importance of convention clearly is important where you're trying to operate a political constitution. But one of the things that I, you know, drew from your book, which I thought was interesting in terms of the debates about the merits, is just how, in some ways, we can deal with things. You know, politics offers that area of discussion and compromise.
Yes.
Whereas law is a little bit more absolute in its judgments. Would that be a good characterization?
Broadly speaking, I agree with that. I don't think that law is a very good way of making what are essentially political decisions. And by political decisions, I mean those which depend on a judgment about policy, particularly on issues where citizens tend to disagree. Mm. Just to give you one example, and one could choose very many, when I was sitting on the Supreme Court, one of the cases I sat on was a case called Nicholson, which was about assisted dying. Mm-hmm. Now, many people felt that Parliament had not dealt with the issue of assisted dying, and it was therefore for the courts to do.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that what I said in my judgment was I think this is a completely unsuitable case for judges to get involved in, because there are no legal criteria by which you can decide it. Ultimately, the only way you can decide an issue like assisted dying is by making a moral judgment, which is likely to be intensely personal, What is a judge going to do other than give legal effect to his personal opinions? That does not seem to me to be a proper way of making law in a democracy. Now, I cite that as a quite a graphic example of the problem of judicial intervention in moral and political issues, but there are very many others.
Yes, I mean, and you discuss the approach to abortion both in the United Kingdom and the United States, and how it's become so polarized, really, in the United States, whereas here we came to a sort of a solution.
Well, I mean, abortion is another very good example. In Europe, abortion, subject to usually to clinical framework of clinical regulation, is lawful in every country other than Malta. And that has been achieved everywhere by statutory enactments. It's not been achieved by judges. One of the reasons why abortion has continued to be very controversial in the United States is that it was achieved by judges. When judges decide an issue like that, they are basically deciding it in a way which renders irrelevant the views of the population at large. An intensely personal and intensely moral issue of that sort, that seems to me to deprive whatever decision they make of its legitimacy. It's also completely poisoned American politics, because for 25 years or so, the presidential elections became, at least in part, a contest for the right to appoint sufficiently biased judges to the Supreme Court so as to ensure that Roe and Wade was overruled. I actually think that Roe and Wade was a terrible decision, although personally I'm in favor of a regulated right of abortion. I just think this is absolutely the wrong way of deciding an issue like that. In Europe, abortion is largely but not entirely uncontroversial, and that's because we dealt with it in a much more sensible way.
I mean, would you say that political constitutions are, well, let me put it this way, would you say that legal constitutions are more brittle and political constitutions more sort of flexible, but at the same time a little bit more vulnerable to abuse?
I would say that the critical difference is actually between presidential systems and parliamentary systems. The US Constitution confers remarkable powers on the president. He is not answerable, as British ministers are, directly to the legislature. Every agent of the federal government is directly answerable to him and not to the legislature. Now, that gives a most extraordinary power of initiative to the president, which is very dangerous if you have a president who is keen to break the mold and rule autocratically, as I think there's no doubt that the current president of the United States is. The advantage of parliamentary systems is that they're much better at dispersing power. And our own history in the last 10 years illustrates that quite well. When Boris Johnson was approaching the end of his prime ministership, he made a direct claim to presidential status. What he said basically was this: you can't get rid of me because I have a personal mandate which I got in the December 2019 general election. That election was essentially an endorsement of me, Boris Johnson. So it'd be unconstitutional to get rid of me. Well, as we discovered 2 days later, that was a serious mistake. Yeah. Now, there is no system which can avoid the problem of completely unsuitable people getting into power. But I think that you can judge a constitution by the ease with which you can get rid of them once you've discovered what a ghastly mistake you have made. And essentially, we have had the experience of two prime ministers who were selected essentially by their party rather than by the electorate at large, who have been efficiently ejected in a way that suggests to me that our constitution is actually working quite well. That doesn't mean to say that everybody approves of the way that it works, but by an objective standard, I think it works well.
No, and I this is exactly a point that, I mean, I had mentioned that if you can get rid of unsuitable people, it shows that the Constitution is working.
Yeah, well, the only way of getting rid of a president of the United States is by impeachment.
Yeah.
And that requires evidence of a high crime or misdemeanor. And that's rather a loose term. I think that all we know about it is that the sexual shenanigans in which Bill Clinton engaged has been authoritatively ruled by the then Chief Justice Rehnquist not to be a high crime or misdemeanor.
Or misdemeanor.
And that seems to me to be sound thinking.
Let me move on to the fragility of democracy that you also look at. And, you know, I was very struck, and I obviously agree that, you know, one of the sympathies that we seem to find among younger people these days for the sort of enlightened autocrat is the best way I can describe it.
Mm.
And their, I suppose, lack of appreciation for the sort of the liberties that democracy may bring. You highlight three key factors, I think, in weakening democracy: ignorance, fear, and economic security. And I thought that was a good way of summing up the ways in which populists, in a sense, may try and take advantage of democratic vulnerabilities.
I mean, historically, economic insecurity has been a very critical factor. Democracy has a very short history.
Mm.
It was really born in the second half of the 19th century. Indeed, if you say you can't be a democracy unless women have the vote, then democracy has an even shorter history. Mm. Women didn't get the vote in France until 1946. So it has a short history, and it has always historically been very heavily dependent on economic good fortune. It was born in Europe and the United States, or North America, at a time of European supremacy, rapid economic expansion. Those were not conditions which you can assume are going to last continually. In particular, in the United States, the United States has had a remarkable degree of economic good fortune since the end of the Civil War in the 1860s. There's really only been one period in the 1930s when that situation has been reversed. Now, what is happening now, I think, is the classic consequence of disappointment about the issue which to most people matters most, namely economic ill winds. What is happening now is that the United States, like all advanced Western economies, is facing competition from low wage but highly educated societies like China and India. And the result has been that within the United States, the center of gravity of the economy has moved towards high-tech areas and away from areas on which middle-class incomes were traditionally based, namely agriculture, extraction, and manufacturing. That has produced enormous, even by American standards, inequalities, which are resented less in the United States than elsewhere, but are still resented. It has done serious damage to the relative economic position of a very large proportion of American citizens. Now, these are not problems peculiar to the United States, but they are very graphically illustrated in the United States, and even in the tech field, which is where the United States is stronger, its lead is becoming progressively shorter, and in some areas like AI, looks like disappearing very soon. That seems to me to be the background over the last generation of the dissatisfaction of the United States electorate with what is happening to them. Now, the problem is, this is really a crisis of expectations. People expect the government to protect them from economic ill winds. And governments have the ability to avoid actually doing damage. But there are relatively few things that they can do to protect about really fundamental economic ill winds like the ones that I've just been discussing. And because people have very high, indeed excessive, expectations of government, they are particularly inclined, when those expectations are disappointed, to turn to other ways of getting their way. There are various other ways. Direct action is one of them. Law is another. But by far the most important is a feeling that strong men get things done in a way that is not true of democratic electorates. Actually, this is all historical experience demonstrates that strong men don't get things done. The problem about strongmanism is that it encourages an approach to power. It encourages decisions to be made on the hoof.
Yes.
It discourages extensive consultation. It encourages flattery at the expense of objective advice. It encourages corruption. All of these things impede reasonable standards of government in a way that can be seen operating at this moment across the Atlantic. I mean, if you want a textbook case of strong men not getting things done, Donald Trump has provided it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a serious factual mistake. But the problem about it is that unlike the resort to law or direct action, resort to strong men can be quite difficult to reverse.
And there is this belief, I mean, certainly among the sort of authoritarian streak, that once you issue a diktat, it's suddenly been, they've actually delivered on what they were trying to do, whereas in actual fact, often it's very not, it's often not actually addressed at all.
Yes, well, I mean, part of this is...
All these executive orders that are coming
Yes,
out.
But you know, if you believe that, I mean, I'm sorry to keep harping on about Trump, but he is such a textbook example of what I'm talking about. It's a subject that's rather
low-hanging
difficult to
fruit,
avoid.
Lord.
Well, indeed. And, you know, basically, Trump exhibits the three classic symptoms of totalitarian government: cult of personality around an individual, a total identification of one man with the state, and an intolerance of any kind of dissent or disagreement. And those are classic symptoms of the deterioration of democratic society.
And they also cultivate, there's also got to be something that you are actively scared of. So it's not just economic security, it's also the cultivation of a fear of something, really, isn't it? I mean, so you...
It's mainly economic insecurity.
It's mainly... You
know? Yeah, I mean, I think that is really where the motive power behind what is happening there is to be found. But, you know, it's not Trump himself. Every society... Every golf club has people like Trump in it. What is really sinister is that 53% of the American electorate apparently want to be ruled by somebody like that. Because, I mean, Trump made no secret of what sort of person he was and what he intended to do and how he intended to do it. There's a lot of people in the States who want it. Much more sinister.
Do you think we've become complacent in the West? Do you think we'd be, I mean...
I think we do tend to take democracy for granted, which is entirely understandable because it's been with us for a long time. And and the trouble is that the way in which democracies fail is generally undramatic.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't tanks on the lawn. There aren't riots in the street. What happens is that governments gradually pour out of the democracy bottle everything that was once inside it that made it democratic. And that can be a process that's quite... difficult to observe. But one thing that we should thank Donald Trump for is that he's in a hurry, and therefore he has done it with a dramatic speed, which has made it pretty obvious what he is about. In most places, it happens much more gradually. If you look at Venezuela under Chavez or Hungary under Orban, it's a much slower and more imperceptible process, and that can be much more dangerous.
One of the things that you raise in the articles you have here is about the role of the public and public opinion in general. And I thought, you know, that is also a fascinating way to look at this sort of possible degradation in democratic values and norms, that there's a sense, as you said, that actually the challenge to free speech now is not normally the state actually anymore. It's actually aspects of society, which I thought was an interesting.
Yes, I mean, this isn't a new insight, because basically the great prophet in this area was John Stuart Mill, writing in the 1850s and 60s, who was in favour of a larger measure of democracy. Indeed, he was one of the very first people to argue coherently in favour of the extension of the vote to women at a time when most people thought that this was unthinkable. But what he foresaw was that the pressure on freedom of speech, and therefore on basic human creativity, was more likely to come from our fellow citizens than from the state. And it's more insidious because, you know, what our fellow citizens will refuse to tolerate is much more difficult to control. You know, legally, it is possible to control the operations of the state in the area of free speech. We don't necessarily do it very well, but we know how to do it. Whereas our fellow citizens are a much more penetrating threat. There is an increasing tendency to feel and to associate with democracy the idea that we should only be allowed to have one view collectively about fundamental moral issues, and therefore that view is something that the majority is entitled to enforce, if not by law, then at least by pressure.
Yeah. I've sort of argued in different places, although probably not very well, but I've sort of argued that what we need is actually some sort of renewal of civic education. But I don't know how the normal response to that is, but this is sort of indoctrination of some sort.
Well,
It can be, but how is it? Would you be in sort of supportive of some idea where we actually educate our public a bit better in terms of?
Well, we're trying to do it at the moment. I mean, there are. I don't actually think we do it terribly well, but we do at least, we have cottoned on to the idea that it's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
And that's a victory of sorts. But, you know, the problem is it's the siloing of opinion. People have always tended to go, for example, for newspapers that reflect views that they agree with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that you can tell quite a lot about what somebody thinks by seeing whether he's carrying a copy of the Telegraph or the Guardian. But these were not impenetrable bubbles.
Yeah.
People were still exposed to contrary ideas. The problem about a world in which a very high proportion of the population do not read newspapers and don't read anything which is subject to any form of editorial control, but derive their news and their views from the internet, is that the algorithms on which the internet works are designed to ensure that they get presented with more of the same things that they agree with and not things that might challenge their view. So you've got a situation in which quite a significant proportion of the population, especially among the young, live in an intellectual bubble which is impervious to contrary opinion. And that is obviously completely inconsistent with any kind of intelligent decision-making at the electoral level. But, you know, that's where ultimately responsibility for the sort of governments we get lies.
So, I mean, you talk about this in terms of, you know, these days we talk about it in terms of polarization. But actually, it's just a form of intolerance, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It's a form of immunity from contradiction.
Yeah. I wanted to move on to another aspect of, you know, among the articles here, and that's really about the law, the role of legal bodies, courts in legislating effectively, and how that, because I think that's also something that I don't think most people sort of fully comprehend necessarily the distinction between, you know, what we might be used to in terms of the role of the law courts and what some of these particularly international bodies that you were talking about. I mean, you focus in this particular case on the ECHR, of course, and there's obviously a great debate about that, and I wondered if we could sort of...
Well, the situation domestically has actually improved considerably since I delivered my Reith lectures on exactly these points in 2019. I mean, it's partly a generational thing, generational of judges. There was a very considerable activist moment over 30 years, which roughly came to an end at the time I retired. That was completely coincidental. I mean, I tried not to make policy from the bench. It didn't seem to me to be my job. But there have been two major decisions of the Supreme Court since 2019, in which the court has held, I think quite rightly, that when a court is called upon to take a view about policy, it shouldn't be inventing policy for itself. It should be taking its cue from the democratic organ of the state, namely the elected House of Commons, from Parliament, essentially. I mean, that seems to me to be a very valuable lesson in a parliamentary system like ours, in which politicians are responsible from day to day to Parliament for what they do. And there's a theory that Parliament doesn't do this very well, but I think actually Parliament does do it well. I mean, I know that there are whips and that party discipline keeps, is powerful. But we have just had yesterday illustration of what happens when a government loses the confidence of its own party on a particular issue. I mean, that can be fortunate or unfortunate. I happen to think yesterday's back down was unfortunate, but that's a matter of opinion and not a matter on which any judge should express an opinion. Of course, he's going to have an opinion, but he should keep it to himself until he's retired.
I mean, one of the other great controversies we have today is the relationship between domestic lawmaking and international lawmaking, and the relationship between, that role of international law. It's something that I deal with and have to grapple with on quite a regular basis. I obviously have my own views on it, but I wondered what how you see that relationship between the international body of law.
Well, I am opposed to the use of international law to determine the contents of domestic law. International law is a very valuable system for governing the relationship between states, including the conduct of military operations. And I certainly wouldn't wish to undermine its role in that context. But increasingly, since the Second World War, international law has assumed the role of determining what standards our domestic law should meet. Now, I've got no problem about that when one's talking about extremes. The Human Rights Convention, the European Human Rights Convention, was designed as a bulwark against tyranny of the sort that had prevailed in Germany and Italy, for example, before the war. In its current form, the Human Rights Convention, which is the principal villain here, it's the creation really of the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. It's no longer recognizable as the instrument that it once was, because the Strasbourg Court has emancipated itself from the text, which is the only thing that the state parties ever actually agreed. And that has involved it turning itself into a fundamentally legislative body. I think that has two major and deplorable consequences. One is that it's contrary to the rule of law, because the first requirement of the rule of law is that the law should be accessible. It should be possible to ascertain what it is and to be guided by it in advance of doing whatever you are going to do. If you have a court that makes it up as it goes along, which is not an unfair description of what the Strasbourg court does, then that is impossible. Nobody until last year would have supposed that a provision which protects the privacy of individuals and the security of their correspondence, was going to be interpreted as requiring governments to have policies about climate change in line with the International Climate Change Panel of the United Nations. But that is what the Strasbourg Court decided in June of last year. And interestingly, and this brings me to the second point, one of the things that they had to do in that case, which is a case brought against Switzerland, was to confront the fact that the reason why why it disapproved of the law was that the Switzerland had failed to enact legislation to give effect to net zero by 2050. It had done so since, but there was a two-year gap when there was no relevant legislation in Switzerland. The reason for that was that Parliament in Switzerland had passed the relevant legislation, but a referendum had disapproved of it. So Switzerland has a stronger and more direct democracy than any other country in the world. So what was the Strasbourg going to make of that? Well, you can discover that if you really have a high boredom threshold by turning to paragraph 412 of their judgment, in which they say, it's been pointed out to us that this is the result of a democratic decision by the Swiss electorate. Well, they said, democracy isn't just a matter of counting up votes. It is, actually. It also depends on the rule of law. You've got to abide by that. Well, democracy is a different. The rule of law is important, but it's not the same thing as democracy. Most countries, including this one, had the rule of law long before they were democracies. What they meant by the rule of law was the rule that we just invented 10 minutes ago in the other paragraphs of this judgment. Now, that illustrates one of the other problem about the Human Rights Convention, which is that it cuts across lines of democratic responsibility. It creates a body of law into which the democratic legislature has no input, and which a democratic legislature is completely incapable of either amending or revoking. Now, I would like to withdraw from the Human Rights Convention, but I wouldn't want to replace it with nothing. I would want it to be enacted in very similar terms in a UK statute, which would then be adjudicated on by courts which are genuinely independent and which are of much higher quality and less, shall we say, adventurous than the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. And that is the answer to people who say we would be putting ourselves in the same corner as Belarus and Russia. Belarus and Russia do not have independent courts, whereas we do. And I think that our courts can be trusted to deal with legislation in the same terms as the Human Rights Convention without causing the problems that the Strasbourg Court has caused in this country and elsewhere.
I mean, to try and sort of draw some sort of common themes in all this, I sort of get the impression that, you know, one of the threats to democratic accountability in a way could be overactive judges.
Yes.
This sort of reflects in some ways a tendency towards a legal rather than a political constitution.
Yes.
And that, one of the ways in which we have to protect the political constitution is to be, and I think you certainly mentioned this, engaged and yes. knowledgeable of the system within which we're operating.
Yes, I mean, standards of public engagement in this country are, by international standards, relatively high. I mean, relatively is the operative word there. There are countries in which ignorance of what is going on in the capital city, let alone in other capital cities, is absolutely terrifying. The United States is a pretty good example of that. Political engagement is important, and I think it has diminished in our lifetimes, well, certainly in my lifetime. One symptom of that is the the very low membership rolls of political parties. It is extraordinary to think that the Conservative Party had 2.8 million members in the mid-1950s, as compared with something like 150,000 at the most now. I think it's impossible to go back to that, because we have it's the result of some very fundamental cultural changes. We have a much less associative social culture now, by which I mean, whereas people went out to clubs and rallies, particularly political clubs, there were many reasons for belonging to a political club which had nothing to do with politics. You know, the Young Conservatives was described in the 1950s as the best dating agency in Britain. And, you know, a lot of people therefore joined political parties for sociable reasons. Obviously, they shared the basic ideology as they saw it of the party in question, but that wasn't why they joined it. I think the way in which we have tended to concentrate our entertainment and our socializing in the home has tended to reduce the importance of the public space in the way that we think about politics. Now, it's unrealistic to think we're going to go back to an age in which there was only one television program and everything, or many more things, were done in public. But what we do need is, I think, a more generalized curiosity about what is happening. And that is, I think you're right in saying a few minutes ago, down to education. I don't think education is a silver bullet. There's a limit to what it can achieve, but it's a good start.
I mean, I think we're coming up to questions shortly, by the way, so do get prepared. I thought I'd just end very quickly on this sort of notion when we talk about education and about political education or historical education. And, you know, you talk about thick and thin rule of law in terms of thick and thin applications. And, you know, a number of historiographers and historians have talked about the fact that we have now a broader study of history, but a thinner understanding of history. And would you say that's a fair description? Obviously not here, but, you know, in general, when we talk about...
Well, I think it is. And I think that the history syllabus in schools has contributed to that. I have always objected to the fact that most schools study European history only over a 30-year period from 1940 to 1945. That is an utterly dismal way of approaching things. Partly, well, one reason for that is that it was the most untypical period of European history. And in particular, it was the most untypical period of German history. People have an idea, I mean, you wouldn't imagine that in the mid-19th century, Germany was regarded by most Englishmen as a place full of dreamy and impractical people who wrote romantic novels. I mean, that was a caricature of Germany in the mid-19th century, but it was a nicer caricature than the sort of jackbooted image which is generated by having to study just those 30 years. If you're going to understand the way that societies work organically, I think you need to study a single society over a considerable period of time. That is a very valuable historical education. And by doing, you know, a bit of Buddhism, a bit of Christianity, a bit of the 4th century, a bit of the 15th century, and a bit of the 20th century, you are actually conveying an understanding of nothing at all. And I think that is very unfortunate. If you're going to study the history of a society over a long period, it's not a bad idea to start with your own society.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think sometimes I worry, as someone who's bringing in, obviously, students into university for the study of history, how modular some of the earlier courses are. And they tend to do, you know, odd bits of, without any context, really. It's a very odd approach, which allows me very well, as you prepare for your questions, to segue into the fact that, as you know, Lord Sumption is the author of a spectacularly good history of the Hundred Years' War, which I would encourage you all to read, all 5 volumes. I've done it, been there, done it. It's brilliant. And it certainly is a masterclass in how to provide narrative contextual history with a good bit of analysis thrown in, I have to say, for those of you who like that sort of thing.
Well, I couldn't have given it a better plug myself.
But I would certainly encourage you to do that. Plus, I have to say, as he did mention, his Reef lectures, which I certainly would encourage you, which, of course, were delivered in 2019, so long before many of the issues that were highlighted came up. So we now have about 20 minutes for questions. I know there are individuals coming around with orange cards. I am not going to pick out. They are going to hand the orange card, and then I will. So let's go for the gentleman there first.
Goodness, you prompt so many questions, it's difficult to know where to start. Let's try with this one. You mentioned the Tocqueville. Now, I got an idea. He said something to the effect that American democracy would last until such time as they realized, the electorate realized they could vote themselves money. Do you think this is actually one of the fundamental problems of democracy?
Until the electorate realize...
They can vote themselves money.
Yes.
Do you think this is one of the fundamental problems? And if so, what can we do about it?
I think that it's part of a wider problem, which is that people tend to vote in general elections for a party that they think will benefit them, rather than voting for a party that they think will benefit society as a whole. Now, if you're going to say to people, you ought to be voting in the interests of society as a whole, that's a very big ask. And there isn't a single society in history where people have done that. So what are people like me doing with this pie in the sky idea that one should, so to speak, vote virtuously? And you know, I mean that in the technical sense. Virtue in the classical world was referring to a state of affairs when you make decisions in the public interest rather than your own. The reason why we need to think seriously about this now is that if we do not vote in the interests of society as a whole, we are now today in a position where we are heading for an alternative that is profoundly horrible and much worse than anything we've got at the moment. So we may have to behave in a way in which human societies have generally not behaved, simply because otherwise we are going to find ourselves much worse, not just financially, but in other ways. Now, obviously, what's in one's financial interest is a large part of that broader problem. I mean, the classic example of that is that only about a third of people between the ages of 18 to 24 vote, whereas about two-thirds of people aged over 65 vote. That is the main reason why the tax system and the pension system is skewed towards people who are over 65. Now, I will hazard a guess that quite a number of people in this tent are over 65, but I mean, I have that much in common with them myself. But to me, the triple lock is totally indefensible, particularly when coupled with a situation in which young people are leaving university with debts of at least £50,000 and are also finding that it's impossible to buy a house until they're getting on for 40, because it is in the interest of existing house owners not to allow too much development. So there is an old v young problem that we have, which is a classic example of the vice that your question quite rightly raises.
Yes, gentlemen.
Thank you. If you are designing a judicial system from scratch, and you have the choice between...
A judicial system, did you say?
Yes.
From scratch.
From scratch, right.
And you have the choice between the selection of the judiciary being made by one person who we might call Jack, who may be influenced well or influenced poorly, and a system where judges are elected by the people. Which would you favour?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want a system where judges are elected by the people. Judges in Britain at the moment are selected by a non-political commission, which I sat on for the first 6 years of its existence. I felt that it has a lay majority, though plenty of legal input. I felt that that system worked quite well. The system of appointment by the government, which was the position before 2005 in this country and still is the position in the United States, only works if there are certain cultural constraints on the way that it works. There are two important cultural restraints. One is that prime ministers or presidents have to be willing to appoint people who are politically not necessarily to their liking. The other is that judges, once appointed, have to forget their political position. Now, a good example of the first problem, the way that that was solved, is that President Reagan appointed Sandra Day O'Connor, one of the great liberal judges in recent history of the United States Supreme Court, and indeed the only Marxist judge ever to be appointed to the High Court in the United Kingdom, was appointed by Lord Hailsham, a conservative Lord Chancellor. That system does work, but the real guarantee is that once you've been appointed to a job in which you've got security of tenure, sensible people start worrying about their personal reputation and the reputation of the court that they've joined. President Eisenhower once said that he'd only made two mistakes in the 8 years in which he was president of the United States, and both of them were sitting on the Supreme Court. And that was because he'd appointed reliable Republicans who then suddenly realized that they had higher responsibilities than just giving effect to their political prejudices. Unfortunately, there's been a bit less of that going on in the United States Supreme Court in recent years. But, you know, that's the ideal.
Thank you so much, because the best way of learning about one's own country is to go to another one. Though I realize two peoples divided by a common language, so I may be misunderstanding. But quick question about democracy. Is there a chance that we're actually dealing right now with a crisis of an elected democracy, where in fact our electors are not making decisions? One reason that they're being kicked into the courts, and particularly in the US, where we've been allowed to make decisions and not pay the consequences because we don't have to have a balanced budget. So we can kind of do everything a little bit and not actually deal with issues like immigration or issues like our burgeoning entitlements.
Well, In the catalogue of problems that you've raised, I think that the most important one is the fact that in the United States, the legislature is immobilized by its own procedures. And that is certainly part of the reason for a greater degree of judicial activism in the past. Stickiness in legislative procedures is a feature of many legislatures, but it's not carried as far as it is in the United States anywhere else. I wouldn't agree with you that a balanced budget is necessary in order to induce people to take the consequences of their acts. I think there are circumstances in which an unbalanced budget may be economically and therefore socially justifiable. This is going back to Keynes. The main reason why politicians don't always have to take the consequences of their own decisions is that those consequences very frequently, particularly on important issues, only become apparent and only become painful over a much longer time than the electoral cycle. The United States has a very short electoral cycle, but even 5 years, which is the commonest electoral cycle and the one that applies in this country, is too short to be able to attack long-term problems and to bring home to politicians the adverse consequences of some of the decisions that they've made. The tendency to say, well, I'll be gone when the problems surface, is an irresistible one, even if it's not always articulated in quite those terms.
I was quite surprised to hear you describe Trump as totalitarian, given the nature of the American state, with you have elected governors who are enormously powerful, you have elected judges, you have elected sheriffs, you have mayors of cities who have far greater powers than our mayors, and the idea that anyone can be a totalitarian leader of America seems to me to be, well, I don't quite understand what you mean by totalitarian in that context.
Well, I gave three symptoms, which I think are characteristic of the totalitarian mind. But I think that you also have to bear in mind that although there are states and there are mayors and there are other sources of power, the extent to which they are dependent on federal funding is very great and has increased considerably over the last century, as a result of which Trump is in a position to say, I will deprive independent universities, independent component states of the USA, or federal funding if they do not comply with my agenda. That is a very powerful piece of motivation. I mean, just to give you one example, there was a quite well-known and well-publicized occasion shortly after Trump's inauguration, where at a meeting of state governors, he rounded on the governor of Maine, who had declined to get rid of DEI policies. And he said, well, I will deprive you of federal funding. And she said, well, all I'm doing in following DEI policies is complying with federal law, to which Trump is reported to have said, I am the federal law. Now, you know, that is a theatrical, like much that Trump does and says, exhibition of his state of mind. The federal government is so powerful that it seems to me that the protection conferred by the distribution of power among these other organs is a lot less significant than it would have been a generation ago.
And I don't think that judges are elected in America, unless I'm wrong. But Lord Sumption, the question that I had is the topic that you're
discussing. Well, judges are elected in some jurisdictions. In some, yes. Not this one.
But not in the. The topic you're discussing is one that I really try not to think about because of a number of factors. One is, you know, the number one job in, I think, 32 out of the 50 states in America is that of a driver. And with the advent of artificial intelligence, that makes for a lot of unemployment in those and other fields. And I wonder whether the pillars that have upheld democracy and the rule of law, really in the post-war period, have ever had to confront the set of circumstances that it looks like they'll have to confront going forward. You have massive demographic changes in terms of average age, but also the cultural composition of major countries across the West. You have, it seems to me, I hope I'm wrong, a massive erosion in education quality and the ability to engage in critical thought in America, but also maybe across much of the West as well. So I wonder how all of this shakes out.
Well, I mean, I think the points that you make are valid and important. And, you know, when the Constitution of the United States was devised, the risk of demagoguery was actually very much present to the minds of the founders, and you only have to read the Federalist Papers to see that that was so. And they believed that the sheer geographical vastness of the United States was a protection against a demagogue, because a demagogue would never be able to reach all the people. Well, you know, that mentality reckoned without even mass distribution newspapers, let alone broadcasting and then the internet. So clearly the challenges that democracies face now and the hill that has to be climbed by any educational system in order to surmount those challenges is really much steeper. You're right.
Right at the back, and then we're coming here to the middle. So the back first.
Thank you, Lord Sumption. Do you consider that low voter engagement is one of the key challenges to UK democracy? And if so, should voting be made compulsory, or is that the very antithesis of democracy?
I think that's a very difficult question, and I have taken a variety of views about it, all inconsistent with each other over the years. It is quite interesting, and possibly not coincidental, that one of the countries in which polling evidence suggests that faith in democracy is strongest is Australia, where voting is compulsory. And in particular, the problem of young people not voting doesn't exist in Australia because they commit an offence if they don't vote. You can spoil your ballot paper, so you can effectively abstain, but you have to turn up to the polling booth. Now, that, I think, is an argument in favour of compulsory voting. On the other hand, one of the countries in Europe where disillusionment with democracy is highest turns out to be Belgium, and Belgium also has compulsory voting. So it may be that some of this is coincidental. We have to see. But the problem about compulsory voting is that I'm not sure that it is wise to make people vote who really don't care enough to vote. So if you really can't be bothered to go to the polling booth, you're not likely to make a particularly valuable contribution to political debate. Now, it may be that if you had to vote, you would say, crikey, I better do some thinking about which the best way to vote is. But that may be too optimistic. I have traditionally felt that encouraging people to vote who would rather not was going to reduce the value of the voting system generally. But I think there's a lot in the idea of compulsory voting, and I may be in the process of changing my mind about that.
I think we have one last question here.
Thank you. I was just wondering if you could comment on the challenges of artificial intelligence as regards violation of intellectual property law, principally copyright, et cetera, as well as the use of AI by solicitors in their briefs, et cetera, which raises some questions of accuracy in some cases. Thank you.
Well, there's always a problem of accuracy if you delegate your thinking to any machine, however able. I'm not sufficiently on top of the technology to be able to give you a useful answer to that question. It seems to me that, I'm always skeptical of people who say our lives will be transformed by some technical development. People have been saying that about the next technical development for centuries. And they've always turned out to be wrong in the past. I remember not so long ago, 25 years ago, there was a theory that all airplanes were going to fall out of the sky in the year 2000 because computers didn't know how to deal with things with more than three zeros or with more than two zeros. It didn't happen. Now, obviously, that's a far stretch from AI. But I think that I have enough vicarious experience from history to feel that most things that were going to transform our lives have either not done so at all, or have done so very slowly, or have done so in circumstances where it would have happened for other reasons anyway.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for attending this session. I think this was a masterclass by Lord Sumption, and I think that a very clear indication of the benefits of a sound historical education. So thank you very much. Thank you to Lord Sumption.